Watership Down by Richard Adams continued. Cassette 4, Side 1. "Who's there?" he said. There was silence, and he was about to speak again when the voice replied, "Zorn! Oh, Zorn!" It came from the hedge along the side of the field. Hazel turned toward the sound, and in a few moments made out under a clump of hemlock the hunched shape of a rabbit. He approached it and said, "Who are you?" But there was no reply. As he hesitated, he heard a movement behind him. "I'm here, Hazel," said Dandelion, in a kind of choking gasp. Together they went closer. The figure did not move as they came up. In the faint starlight they both saw a rabbit as real as themselves, a rabbit in the last stages of exhaustion, its back legs trailing behind its flattened rump as though paralyzed. A rabbit that stared white-eyed from one side to the other, seeing nothing, yet finding no respite from its fear, and then felt a licking wretchedly at one ripped and bloody ear that drooped across its face. A rabbit that suddenly cried and wailed as though entreating the thousand to come from every quarter to rid it of a misery too terrible to be borne. It was Captain Holly of the Sandalford Ausla. Chapter 20. A Honeycomb and a Mouse. His face was that of one who has undergone a long journey, the Epic of Gilgamesh. In the Sandalford Warren, Holly had been a rabbit of consequence. He was greatly relied upon by the Threera, and had more than once carried out difficult orders with a good deal of courage. During the early spring, when a fox had moved into a neighboring copse, Holly, with two or three volunteers, had kept it steadily under observation for several days, and reported all its movements, until one evening it left as suddenly as it had come. Although he had decided on his own initiative to arrest Bigwig, he had not the reputation of being vindictive. He was, rather, a stander of no-nonsense who knew when duty was done and did it himself. Sound, unassuming, conscientious, a bit lacking in the rabbit sense of mischief, he was something of the born second in command. There could have been no question of trying to persuade him to leave the warren with Hazel and Fiver. To find him under Watership Down at all, therefore, was astonishing enough, but to find him in such a condition was all but incredible. In the first moments after they'd recognized the poor creature under the hemlock, Hazel and Dandelion felt completely stupefied, as though they had come upon a squirrel underground or a stream that flowed uphill. They could not trust their senses. The voice in the dark had proved not to be supernatural, but the reality was frightening enough. How could Captain Holly be here at the foot of the down, and what could have reduced him, of all rabbits, to this state? Hazel pulled himself together. Whatever the explanation might be, the immediate need was to take first things first. They were in open country at night, away from any refuge but an overgrown ditch, with a rabbit who smelled of blood, was crying uncontrollably, and looked as though he could not move. There might very well be a stoat on his trail at this moment. If they were going to help him, they had better be quick. "Go and tell Bigwig who it is," he said to Dandelion, "and come back with him. Send Speedwell up the hill to the others, and tell him to make it clear that no one is to come down. They couldn't help, and it would only add to the risk." Dandelion had no sooner gone than Hazel became aware that something else was moving in the hedge. But he had no time to wonder what it might be, for almost immediately another rabbit appeared and limped to where Holly was lying. "You must help us if you can," he said to Hazel. "We've had a very bad time, and my master's ill. Can we get underground here?" Hazel recognized him as one of the rabbits who had come to arrest Bigwig, but he did not know his name. "Why did you stay in the hedge and leave him to crawl about in the open?" he asked. "I ran away when I heard you coming," replied the other rabbit. "I couldn't get the captain to move. I thought you were ill, and there was no point in staying to be killed. I don't think I could fight a field mouse." "Do you know me?" said Hazel. But before the other could answer, Dandelion and Bigwig came out of the darkness. Bigwig stared at Holly for a moment, and then crouched before him and touched noses. "Holly, this is Thlaley," he said. "You were calling me." Holly did not answer, but only stared fixedly back at him. Bigwig looked up. "Who's that who came with him?" he said. "Oh, it's you, Bluebell. How many more of you?" "No more," said Bluebell. He was about to go on when Holly spoke.
"Flaily," he said. "So we have found you."
He sat up with difficulty and looked round at them.
"You're Hazel, aren't you?" he asked. "And that's... oh, I should know, but I'm in very poor shape, I'm afraid."
"It's Dandelion," said Hazel. "Listen, I can see that you're exhausted, but we can't stay here. We're in danger. Can you come with us to our holes?"
"Captain," said Bluebell, "do you know what the first blade of grass said to the second blade of grass?"
Hazel looked at him sharply, but Holly replied,
"Well?"
"It said, 'Look, there's a rabbit. We're in danger.'"
"This is no time," began Hazel. "Don't silence him," said Holly. "We wouldn't be here at all without his blue tits chatter."
"Yes, I can go now. Is it far?" "Not too far," said Hazel, thinking it all too likely that Holly would never get there. It took a long time to climb the hill. Hazel made them separate, himself remaining with Holly and Bluebell, while Bigwig and Dandelion went out to either side. Holly was forced to stop several times, and Hazel, full of fear, had hard work to suppress his impatience. Only when the moon began to rise, the edge of its great disk growing brighter and brighter on the skyline below and behind them, did he at last beg Holly to hurry. As he spoke, he saw in the white light Pipkin coming down to meet them.
"What are you doing?" he said sternly. "I told Speedwell no one was to come down."
"It isn't Speedwell's fault," said Pipkin. "You stood by me at the river, so I thought I'd come and look for you, Hazel. Anyway, the holes are just here. Is it really Captain Holly you found?"
Bigwig and Dandelion approached. "I'll tell you what," said Bigwig. "These two will need to rest for a good long time. Suppose Pipkin here and Dandelion take them to an empty burrow and stay with them as long as they want. The rest of us had better keep away until they feel better."
"Yes, that's best," said Hazel.
"I'll go up with you now." They ran the short distance to the thorn trees. All the other rabbits were above ground, waiting and whispering together.
"Shut up," said Bigwig, before anyone had asked a question.
"Yes, it is Holly, and Bluebell is with him. No one else. They're in a bad way, and they're not to be troubled. We'll leave this hole empty for them. Now I'm going underground myself, and so will you, if you've got any sense."
But before he went, Bigwig turned to Hazel and said, "You got yourself out of that ditch down there instead of me, didn't you, Hazel? I shan't forget that." Hazel remembered Buckthorn's leg and took him down with him. Speedwell and Silver followed them.
"I say, what's happened, Hazel?" asked Silver. "It must be something very bad. Holly would never leave the Threera."
"I don't know," replied Hazel. "And neither does anyone else yet. We'll have to wait until tomorrow. Holly may stop running, but I don't think Bluebell will. Now let me alone to do this leg of Buckthorn's." The wound was a great deal better, and soon Hazel fell asleep. The next day was as hot and cloudless as the last. Neither Pipkin nor Dandelion was at Morning Sylphlay, and Hazel relentlessly took the others up to the beach hangar to go on with the digging. He questioned Strawberry about the great burrow and learned that its ceiling, as well as being vaulted with a tangle of fibers, was strengthened by roots going vertically down into the floor. He remarked that he had not noticed these.
"Well, there aren't many, but they're important," said Strawberry. "They take a lot of the load. If it weren't for those roots, the ceiling would fall after heavy rain. On stormy nights you could sense the extra weight in the earth above, but there was no danger."
Hazel and Bigwig went underground with him. The beginnings of the new warren had been hollowed out among the roots of one of the beech trees. It was still no more than a small, irregular cave with one entrance. They set to work to enlarge it, digging between the roots and tunneling upward to make a second run that would emerge inside the wood. After a time, Strawberry stopped digging and began moving about between the roots, sniffing, biting, and scuffling in the soil with his front paws. Hazel supposed that he was tired and pretending to be busy while he had a rest, but at length he came back to them and said that he had some suggestions.
"It's this way," he explained. "There isn't a big spread of fine roots above here. That was a lucky chance in the great burrow, and I don't think you can expect to find it again. But all the same, we can do pretty well with what we've got."
"And what have we got?" asked Blackberry, who'd come down the run while he was talking.
Well, we've got several thick roots that go straight down, more than there were in the great burrow. The best thing will be to dig round them and leave them. They shouldn't be gnawed through and taken out. We shall need them if we're going to have a hall of any size.
Then our hall will be full of these thick vertical roots? Asked Hazel. He felt disappointed.
Yes, it will, said Strawberry. But I can't see that it's going to be any the worse for that. We can go in and out among them, and they won't hinder anyone who's talking or telling a story. They make the place warmer, and they'll help to conduct sound from above, which might be useful some time or other.
The excavation of the hall, which came to be known among them as the Honeycomb, turned out to be something of a triumph for Strawberry. Hazel contented himself with organizing the diggers and left it to Strawberry to say what was actually to be done. The work went on in shifts, and the rabbits took it in turns to feed, play, and lie in the sun above ground. Throughout the day the solitude remained unbroken by noise, men, tractors, or even cattle, and they began to feel still more deeply what they owed to Fiver's insight. By the late afternoon the big burrow was beginning to take shape. At the north end the beech roots formed a kind of irregular colonnade. This gave way to a more open central space, and beyond, where there were no supporting roots, Strawberry left blocks of the earth untouched, so that the south end consisted of three or four separate bays. These narrowed into low-roofed runs that led away into sleeping burrows. Hazel, much better pleased now that he could see for himself how the business was going to turn out, was sitting with Silver in the mouth of the run, when suddenly there was a stamping of, "Hawk! Hawk!" and a dash for cover by the rabbits outside. Hazel, safe where he was, remained looking out past the shadow of the wood to the open sunlit grass beyond. The kestrel sailed into view and took up station, the black-edged flange of its tail bent down and its pointed wings beating rapidly as it searched the down below.
"But do you think it would attack us?" asked Hazel, watching it drop lower and recommence its poised fluttering. "Surely it's too small."
"You're probably right," replied Silver. "All the same, would you care to go out there and start feeding?"
"I'd like to try standing up to some of these aliens," said Bigwig, who had come up the run behind them. "We're afraid of too many. But a bird from the air would be awkward, especially if it came fast. It might get the better of even a big rabbit if it took him by surprise."
"See the mouse?" said Silver suddenly. "There, look, poor little beast."
They could all see the field mouse, which was exposed in a patch of smooth grass. It had evidently strayed too far from its hole, and now could not tell what to do. The kestrel's shadow had not passed over it, but the rabbit's sudden disappearance had made it uneasy, and it was pressed to the ground, looking uncertainly this way and that. The kestrel had not yet seen it, but could hardly fail to do so as soon as it moved.
"Any moment now," said Bigwig callously.
On an impulse, Hazel hopped down the bank and went a little way into the open grass. Mice do not speak Lapine, but there is a very simple, limited lingua franca of the hedgerow and woodland. Hazel used it now.
"Run," he said. "Here, quick."
The mouse looked at him, but did not move. Hazel spoke again, and the mouse began suddenly to run toward him as the kestrel turned and slid sideways and downward. Hazel hastened back to the hole. Looking out, he saw the mouse following him. When it had almost reached the foot of the bank, it scuttered over a fallen twig with two or three green leaves. The twig turned. One of the leaves caught the sunlight slanting through the trees, and Hazel saw it flash for an instant. Immediately the kestrel came lower in an oblique glide, closed its wings, and dropped. Before Hazel could spring back from the mouth of the hole, the mouse had dashed between his front paws and was pressed to the ground between his back legs. At the same moment the kestrel, all beak and talons, hit the loose earth immediately outside like a missile thrown from the tree above. It scuffled savagely, and for an instant the three rabbits saw its round, dark eyes looking straight down the run. Then it was gone. The speed and force of the pounce, not a length away, were terrifying, and Hazel leaped backward, knocking Silver off his balance. They picked themselves up in silence.
"Like to try standing up to that one?" said Silver, looking round at Bigwig. "Let me know when. I'll come and watch."
"Hazel," said Bigwig, "I know you're not stupid, but what did we get out of that? Are you going in for protecting every mole and shrew that can't get underground?"
The mouse had not moved. It was still crouching a little inside the run, on a level with their heads and outlined against the light. Hazel could see it watching him.
"Perhaps Hawk not gone," he said. "You stay now, go later." Bigwig was about to speak again when Dandelion appeared in the mouth of the hole. He looked at the mouse, pushed it gently aside, and came down the run. "Hazel," he said, "I thought I ought to come and tell you about Holly. He's much better this evening, but he had a very bad night, and so did we. Every time he seemed to be going to sleep, he kept starting up and crying. I thought he was going out of his mind. Pipkin kept talking to him. He was first rate, and he seems to set a lot of store by Bluebell. Bluebell kept on making jokes. He was worn out before the morning, and so were the lot of us. We've been sleeping all day. Holly's been more or less himself since he woke up this afternoon, and he's been up to Silfle. He asked where you and the others would be tonight, and as I didn't know, I came to ask."
"Is he fit to talk to us, then?" asked Bigwig.
"I think so. It would be the best thing for him, if I'm any judge. And if he was with all of us together, he'd be less likely to have another bad night."
"Well, where are we going to sleep?" said Silver.
Hazel considered. The honeycomb was still rough-dug and half-finished, but it would probably be as comfortable as the holes under the thorn trees. Besides, if it proved otherwise, they would have all the more inducement to improve it. To know that they were actually making use of their day's hard work would please everybody, and they were likely to prefer this to a third night in the chalk holes.
"I should think here," he said, "but we'll see how the others feel."
"What's this mouse doing in here?" asked Dandelion.
Hazel explained. Dandelion was as puzzled as Bigwig had been.
"Well, I'll admit I hadn't any particular idea when I went out to help it," said Hazel.
"I have now, though, and I'll explain later what it is. But first of all, Bigwig and I ought to go and talk to Holly. And Dandelion, you go and tell the rest what you told me, will you, and see what they want to do tonight."
They found Holly with Bluebell and Pipkin on the turf by the anthill where Dandelion had first looked over the down. Holly was sniffing at a purple orchis. The head of mauve blooms rocked gently on its stem as he pushed his nose against it.
"Don't frighten it, master," said Bluebell. "It might fly away. After all, it's got a lot of spots to choose from. Look at them, all over the leaves."
"Oh, get along with you, Bluebell," answered Holly good-humoredly. "We need to learn about the ground here. Half the plants are strange to me. This isn't one to eat. But at least there's plenty of burnet, and that's always good."
A fly settled on his wounded ear, and he winced and shook his head. Hazel was glad to see that Holly was evidently in better spirits. He began to say that he hoped he felt well enough to join the others, but Holly soon interrupted him with questions.
"Are there many of you?" he asked.
"Prayer," said Bigwig.
"All that left the warren with you?"
"Every one," replied Hazel proudly.
"No one hurt?"
"Oh, several have been hurt one way and another."
"Never a dull moment, really," said Bigwig.
"Who's this coming? I don't know him."
Strawberry came running down from the hangar, and as he joined them began to make the same curious dancing gesture of head and forepaws which they had first seen in the rainy meadow before they entered the great burrow. He checked himself in some confusion, and to forestall Bigwig's rebuke spoke to Hazel at once.
"Hazelrah," he said. Holly looked startled, but said nothing. "Everyone wants to stay in the new warren tonight, and they're all hoping that Captain Holly will feel able to tell them what's happened and how he came here."
"Well, naturally, we all want to know," said Hazel to Holly.
"This is Strawberry. He joined us on our journey, and we've been glad to have him. But do you think you can manage it?"
"I can manage it," said Holly. "But I must warn you that it will strike the frost into the heart of every rabbit that hears it."
He himself looked so sad and dark as he spoke that no one made any reply, and after a few moments all six rabbits made their way up the slope in silence. When they reached the corner of the wood, they found the others feeding or basking in the evening sun on the north side of the beech trees. After a glance round among them, Holly went up to Silver, who was feeding with Fiver in a patch of yellow trefoil.
"I'm glad to see you here, Silver," he said. "I hear you've had a rough time."
"It hasn't been easy," answered Silver. "Hazel's done wonders, and we owe a lot to Fiver here as well."
"I've heard of you," said Holly, turning to Fiver. "You're the rabbit who saw it all coming. You talked to the Threera, didn't you?"
"He talked to me," said Fiver.
"If only he'd listened to you. Well, it can't be changed now till acorns grow on thistles. Silver, there's something I want to say, and I can say it more easily to you than to Hazel or Bigwig. I'm not out to make any trouble here.
Trouble for Hazel, I mean. He's your chief rabbit now, that's plain. I hardly know him, but he must be good or you'd all be dead, and this is no time to be squabbling. If any of the other rabbits are wondering whether I might want to alter things, will you let them know that I shan't?
Yes, I will, said Silver.
Bigwig came up.
I know it's not owl time yet, he said, but everyone's so eager to hear you, Holly, that they want to go underground at once. Will that suit you?
Underground, replied Holly.
But how can you all hear me underground? I was expecting to talk here.
Come and see, said Bigwig.
Holly and Bluebell were impressed by the honeycomb.
This is something quite new, said Holly. What keeps the roof up?
It doesn't need to be kept up, said Bluebell.
It's right up the hill already. An idea we found on the way, said Bigwig.
Lying in a field, said Bluebell. It's all right, Master, I'll be quiet while you're speaking.
Yes, you must, said Holly. Soon no one will want jokes.
Almost all the rabbits had followed them down. The honeycomb, though big enough for everybody, was not so airy as the great burrow, and on this June evening it seemed somewhat close.
We can easily make it cooler, you know, said Strawberry to Hazel. In the great burrow they used to open tunnels for the summer and close them for the winter. We can dig another run on the evening side tomorrow and pick up the breeze.
Hazel was just going to ask Holly to begin when Speedwell came down the eastern run.
Hazel, he said, you're a visitor? Your mouse? He wants to speak to you.
Oh, I'd forgotten him, said Hazel. Where is he?
Up the run.
Hazel went up. The mouse was waiting at the top.
You go now, said Hazel. You think safe?
Go now, said the mouse. No wait, owl. But what I like a say, you help a mouse, one time a mouse help you. You want him, he come.
Frith in a pond, muttered Bigwig further down the run.
And so will all his brothers and sisters. I dare say the place will be crawling. Why don't you ask him to dig us a burrow or two, Hazel?
Hazel watched the mouse make off into the long grass. Then he returned to the honeycomb and settled down near Holly, who had just begun to speak. Chapter 21 For El-Are-Ra to Cry. Love the animals. God has given them the rudiments of thought and joy untroubled. Don't trouble it. Don't harass them. Don't deprive them of their happiness. Don't work against God's intent. Dostoevsky, The Brothers Karamazov. Acts of injustice done between the setting and the rising sun in history lie like bones, each one. W. H. Auden, The Ascent of F6. The night you left the warren, the Ausler were turned out to look for you. How long ago it seems now. We followed your scent down to the brook, but when we told the Threerer that you appeared to have set off downstream, he said there was no point in risking lives by following you. If you were gone, you were gone. But anyone who came back was to be arrested. So then I called off the search. Nothing unusual happened the next day. There was a certain amount of talk about Fiver and the rabbits who'd gone with him. Everyone knew that Fiver had said that something bad was going to happen, and all sorts of rumors started. A lot of rabbits said there was nothing in it, but some thought that Fiver might have foreseen men with guns and ferrets. That was the worst thing anyone could think of, that or the white blindness. Willow and I talked things over with the Threerer.
"These rabbits," he said, "who claim to have the second sight, I've known one or two in my time, but it's not usually advisable to take much notice of them. For one thing, many are just plain mischievous. A weak rabbit who can't hope to get far by fighting sometimes tries to make himself important by other means, and prophecy's a favorite. The curious thing is that when he turns out to be wrong, his friends seldom seem to notice as long as he puts on a good act and keeps talking. But then again, you may get a rabbit who really has this odd power, for it does exist. He foretells a flood, perhaps, or ferrets and guns. All right. So a certain number of rabbits will stop running.
What's the alternative?
To evacuate a warren is a tremendous business. Some refuse to go. The chief rabbit leaves with as many as will come. His authority is likely to be put to the most severe test, and if he loses it, he won't get it back in a hurry. At the best, you've got a big bunch of flessel trailing around in the open, probably with does and kittens tacked on. Ellie'll appear in hordes. The remedy is worse than the disease. Almost always, it's better for the warren as a whole if rabbits sit tight and do their best to dodge their dangers underground.
Of course, I never sat down and thought, said Fiver. It would take the Threera to think all that out. I simply had the screaming horrors. Great golden frith, I hope I never have them like that again. I shall never forget it. That and the night I spent under the yew tree. Oh, there's terrible evil in the world.
It comes from men, said Holly. All other Ellil do what they have to do, and Frith moves them as he moves us. They live on the earth, and they need food. Men will never rest till they've spoiled the earth and destroyed the animals. But I'd better go on with this tale of mine. The next day, in the afternoon, it began to rain. Those scrapes we dug in the bank, whispered Buckthorn to Dandelion. Everyone was underground, just chewing pellets or sleeping. I'd gone up for a few minutes to pass Raka. I was on the edge of the wood, quite near the ditch, when I saw some men come through the gate at the top of the opposite slope, up by that board thing. I don't know how many there were, 3 or 4, I suppose. They had long black legs, and they were burning white sticks in their mouths. They didn't seem to be going anywhere. They began walking slowly about in the rain, looking at the hedges and the brook. After a time, they crossed the brook and came clumping up toward the warren. Whenever they came to a rabbit hole, one of them would prod at it, and they kept talking all the time. I remember the smell of the elder bloom in the rain and the smell of the white sticks. Later, when they came closer, I slipped underground again. I could hear them for some time thumping about and talking. I kept thinking, well, they've got no guns and no ferrets. But somehow I didn't like it.
What did the Threera say? Asked Silver.
I've no idea. I didn't ask him, and neither did anyone else, as far as I know. I went to sleep, and when I woke, there was no sound up above. It was evening, and I decided to sylflay. The rain had settled in, but I pottered round and fed for a while all the same. I couldn't see that anything was altered, except that here and there the mouth of a hole had been poked in. The next morning was clear and fine. Everyone was out for sylflay, as usual. I remember Nightshade told the Threera that he ought to be careful not to tire himself now that he was getting on in years, and the Threera said he'd show him who was getting on in years and cuffed him and pushed him down the bank. It was all quite good-humored, you know, but he did it just to show Nightshade that the chief rabbit was still a match for him. I was going out for lettuces that morning, and for some reason or other, I decided to go alone. 3's the usual number for a lettuce party, said Bigwig.
Yes, I know. 3 used to be the usual number, but there was some special reason why I went alone that day. Oh, yes, I remember. I wanted to see if there were any early carrots. I thought they might just be ready, and I reckoned that if I was going hunting about in a strange part of the garden, I'd be better off by myself. I was out most of the morning, and it can't have been long before Nefrith when I came back through the wood. I was coming down Silent Bank. I know most rabbits preferred the green loose, but I nearly always went by Silent Bank. I'd got into the open part of the wood where it comes down toward the old fence when I noticed a hurdadoo in the lane at the top of the opposite slope. It was standing at the gate by the board, and a lot of men were getting out. There was a boy with them, and he had a gun. They took down some big, long things. I don't know how to describe them to you. They were made of the same sort of stuff as hurdadoo, and they must have been heavy because it took 2 men to carry one of them. The men carried these things into the field, and the few rabbits who were above ground went down. I didn't. I'd seen the gun, and I thought they were probably going to use ferrets and perhaps nets, so I stayed where I was and watched. I thought, as soon as I'm sure what they're up to, I'll go and warn the Threera. There was more talking, and more white sticks. Men never hurry, do they? Then one of them got a spade and began filling in the mouths of all the holes he could find. Every hole he came to, he cut out the turf above and pushed it into the hole. That puzzled me, because with ferrets they want to drive the rabbits out. But I was expecting that they leave a few holes open and net them, although that would have been a foolish way to ferret, because a rabbit that went up a blocked run would be killed underground, and then the man wouldn't get his ferret back very easily, you know?
Don't make it too grim, Holly, said Hazel.
for Pipkin was shuddering at the thought of the block run and the pursuing ferret.
"Too grim," replied Holly bitterly. "I've hardly started yet. Would anyone like to go away?"
No one moved, and after a few moments he continued. "Then another of the men fetched some long, thin, bending things. I haven't got words for all these men things, but there was something like lengths of very thick bramble. Each of the men took one and put it on one of the heavy things. There was a kind of hissing noise, and, well, I know you must find this difficult to understand, but the air began to turn bad. For some reason I got a strong scent of this stuff that came out of the bramble things, even though I was some way off and I couldn't see or think. I seemed to be falling. I tried to jump up and run, but I didn't know where I was, and I found I'd run down to the edge of the wood toward the men. I stopped just in time. I was bewildered, and I'd lost all idea of warning the Freera. After that, I just sat where I was. The men put a bramble into each hole they'd left open, and after that, nothing happened for a little while. And then I saw Scabious. You remember Scabious? He came out of a hole along the hedge, one they hadn't noticed. I could see at once that he'd smelled this stuff. He didn't know what he was doing. The men didn't see him for a few moments, and then one of them stuck out his arm to show where he was, and the boy shot him. He didn't kill him. Scabious began to scream, and one of the men went over and picked him up and hit him. I really believe he may not have suffered very much, because the bad air had turned him silly, but I wish I hadn't seen it. After that, the man stopped up the hole that Scabious had come out of. By this time, the poisoned air must have been spreading through the runs and burrows underground. I can imagine what it must have been like.
You can't, said Bluebell.
Holly stopped, and after a pause, Bluebell went on. I heard the commotion beginning before I smelled the stuff myself. The does seemed to get it first, and some of them began trying to get out. But the ones who had litters wouldn't leave the kittens, and they were attacking any rabbit who came near them. They wanted to fight to protect the kittens, you know? Very soon, the runs were crammed with rabbits clawing and clamoring over each other. They went up the runs they were accustomed to use and found them blocked. Some managed to turn round, but they couldn't get back because of the rabbits coming up. And then the runs began to be blocked lower down with dead rabbits, and the live rabbits tore them to pieces. I shall never know how I got away with what I did. It was a chance in a thousand. I was in a burrow near one of the holes that the men were using. It made a lot of noise putting the bramble thing in, and I've got an idea it wasn't working properly. As soon as I picked up the smell of the stuff, I jumped out of the burrow, but I was still fairly clear-headed. I came up the run just as the men were taking the bramble out again. They were all looking at it and talking, and they didn't see me. I turned around, actually, in the mouth of the hole and went down again. Do you remember the slack run? I suppose hardly a rabbit went down there in our lifetime. It was so very deep, and it didn't lead anywhere in particular. No one knows even who made it. Frith must have guided me, for I went straight down into the slack run and began creeping along it. I was actually digging at times. It was all loose earth and fallen stones. There were all sorts of forgotten shafts and drops that led in from above, and down those were coming the most terrible sounds. Cries for help, kittens squealing for their mothers, Ousla trying to give orders, rabbits cursing and fighting each other. Once a rabbit came tumbling down one of the shafts, and his claws just scratched me, like a horse chestnut burr falling in autumn. It was Celandine, and he was dead. I had to tear at him before I could get over him. The place was so low and narrow. And then I went on. I could smell the bad air, but I was so deep down that I must have been beyond the worst of it. Suddenly I found there was another rabbit with me. He was the only one I met in the whole length of the slack run. It was Pimpernel. And I could tell at once that he was in a bad way. He was spluttering and gasping, but he was able to keep going. He asked if I was all right, but all I said was, "Where do we get out?" "I can show you that," he said, "if you can help me along." So I followed him, and every time he stopped, he kept forgetting where we were. I shoved him hard. I even bit him once. I was terrified that he was going to die and block the run. At last, we began to come up, and I could smell fresh air. We found we'd got into one of those runs that led out into the wood.
The men had done their work badly, resumed Holly. Either they didn't know about the wood holes, or they couldn't be bothered to come and block them. Almost every rabbit that came up in the field was shot, but I saw two get away. One was nose in the air, but I don't remember who the other was.
The noise was very frightening, and I would have run myself, but I kept waiting to see whether the Threero would come. After a while, I began to realize that there were a few other rabbits in the wood. Pine Needles was there, I remember, and Butterbur and Ash. I got hold of all I could and told them to sit tight under cover. After a long time, the men finished. They took the bramble things out of the holes, and the boy put the bodies on a stick. Holly stopped and pressed his nose under Big Wig's flank. "Well, never mind about that bit," said Hazel in a steady voice. "Tell us how you came away."
"Before that happened," said Holly, "a great hootadoo came into the field from the lane. It wasn't the one the men came in. It was very noisy, and it was yellow, as yellow as charlock. And in front there was a great silver shining thing that it held in its huge front paws. I don't know how to describe it to you. It looked like inlay, but it was broad and not so bright. And this thing, how could I tell you? It tore the field to bits. It destroyed the field."
He stopped again. "Captain," said Silver, "we all know you've seen things bad beyond telling. But surely that's not quite what you mean."
"Upon my life," said Holly, trembling, "it buried itself in the ground and pushed great masses of earth in front of it until the field was destroyed. The whole place became like a cattle wade in winter, and you could no longer tell where any part of the field had been between the wood and the brook. Earth and roots and grass and bushes it pushed before it, and other things as well from underground." After a long time, I went back through the wood. I'd forgotten any idea of collecting other rabbits, but there were three who joined me all the same, Bluebell here and Pimpernel and young Toadflax. Toadflax was the only member of the Ousla I'd seen, and I asked him about the Threera, but he couldn't talk any kind of sense. I never found out what happened to the Threera. I hope he died quickly. Pimpernel was light-headed, chattering nonsense, and Bluebell and I weren't much better. For some reason, all I could think of was Bigwig. I remembered how I'd gone to arrest him, to kill him, really, and felt I had to find him and tell him I'd been wrong. And this idea was all the sense I had left. The four of us went wandering away, and we must have gone almost in a half-circle, because after a long time we came to the brook below what had been our field. We followed it down into a big wood, and that night, while we were still in the wood, Toadflax died. He was clear-headed for a short time before, and I remember something he said. Bluebell had been saying that he knew the men hated us for raiding their crops and gardens, and Toadflax answered, "That wasn't why they destroyed the warren. It was just because we were in their way. They killed us to suit themselves." Soon after that, he went to sleep. And a little later, when we were alarmed by some noise or other, we tried to wake him and realized he was dead. We left him lying where he was and went on until we reached the river. I needn't describe it, because I know you were all there. It was morning by this time. We thought you might be somewhere near, and we began to go along the bank upstream looking for you. It wasn't long before we found the place where you must have crossed. There were tracks, a great many, in the sand under a steep bank, and Fraca about 3 days old. The tracks didn't go upstream or downstream, so I knew you must have gone over. I swam across and found more tracks on the other side, so then the others came over too. The river was high. I suppose you must have had it easier before all the rain. I didn't like the fields on the other side of the river. There was a man with a gun who kept walking everywhere. I took the other two on across a road, and soon we came to a bad place, all heather and soft black earth. We had a hard time there, but again I came upon Raka about 3 days old and no signs of holes or rabbits, so I thought there was a chance that they were yours. Bluebell was all right, but Pimpernel was feverish, and I was afraid he was going to die too. Then we had a bit of luck, or so we thought at the time. That night we fell in with a Khaleesi on the edge of the heather. An old tough rabbit with his nose all scratched and scarred, and he told us that there was a warren not far off and showed us which way to go. We came to woods and fields again, but we were so much exhausted that we couldn't start looking for the warren. We crept into a ditch, and I hadn't the heart to tell one of the others to keep awake. I tried to keep awake myself, but I couldn't.
When was this? Asked Hazel.
The day before yesterday, said Holly, early in the morning. When I woke, it was still some time before Nefrith. Everything was quiet, and all I could smell was rabbit, and I felt at once that something was wrong. I woke Bluebell, and I was just going to wake Pippinel when I realized that there was a whole bunch of rabbits all around us. They were great big fellows, and they had a very odd smell. It was like, well, like...
We know what it was like, said Fiver.
I thought you probably did. Then one of them said, My name's Cowslip. Who are you, and what are you doing here? I didn't like the way he spoke, but I couldn't see that they had any reason to wish us harm, so I told them that we'd had a bad time and come a long way, and that we were looking for some rabbits from our own warren, Hazel, Fiver, and Bigwig. As soon as I said those names, this rabbit turned to the others and cried, I knew it! Tear them to pieces! And they all set on us. One of them got me by the ear and ripped it up before Bluebell could pull him off. We were fighting the lot of them. I was so much taken by surprise that I couldn't do a great deal at first. But the funny thing was that although they were so big and yelling for our blood, they couldn't fight at all. They obviously didn't know the first thing about fighting. Bluebell knocked down a couple twice his size, and although my ear was pouring with blood, I was never really in danger. All the same, they were too many for us, and we had to run. Bluebell and I had just got clear of the ditch when we realized that Pimpernel was still there. He was ill, as I told you, and he didn't wake in time. So after all he'd been through, poor Pimpernel was killed by rabbits. What do you think of that?
I think it was a damned shame, said Strawberry, before anyone else could speak.
We were running down the fields beside a little stream, Holly went on. Some of these rabbits were still chasing us, and suddenly I thought, well, I'll have one of them anyway. I didn't care for the idea of doing nothing more than just run away to save our skins, not after Pimpernel. I saw that this Cowslip was ahead of the others and out on his own, so I let him catch me up, and then I suddenly turned and went for him. I had him down, and I was just going to rip him up when he squealed out, I could tell you where your friends have gone. Hurry up, then, I said, with my back legs braced in his stomach. They've gone to the hills, he panted, the high hills you can see away over there. They went yesterday morning. I pretended not to believe him, and acted as though I was going to kill him. But he didn't alter his story, so I scratched him and let him go, and away we came. It was clear weather, and we could see the hills plainly enough. After that, we had the worst time of all. If it hadn't been for Bluebell's jokes and chatter, we'd have stopped running for certain. Hraka one end, jokes the other, said Bluebell. I used to roll a joke along the ground, and we both followed it. That was how we kept going. I can't really tell you much about the rest of it, said Holly. My ear was terribly painful, and all the time I kept thinking that Pimpernel's death was my fault. If I hadn't gone to sleep, he wouldn't have died. Once we tried to sleep again, but my dreams were more than I could bear. I was out of my mind, really. I had only this one idea, to find Bigwig and tell him that he'd been right to leave the warren. At last we reached the hills just at nightfall of the next day. We were past caring. We came over the flat, open land at owl time. I don't know what I'd been expecting. You know how you let yourself think that everything will be all right if you can only get to a certain place or do a certain thing, but when you get there you find it's not that simple? I suppose I'd had some sort of foolish notion that Bigwig would be waiting to meet us. We found the hills were enormous, bigger than anything we'd ever seen. No woods, no cover, no rabbits, and night setting in. And then everything seemed to go to pieces. I saw Scabious as plain as grass and heard him crying, too. And I saw the Threera and Toadflax and Pimpernel. I tried to talk to them. I was calling Bigwig, but I didn't really expect him to hear because I was sure he wasn't there.